This is the Ask Chef Jake a podcast, episode 9. Let's talk about becoming a chef. Here we go with another episode of Ask Chef Jacob. Thank you so much for joining me. We're calling this episode Tips on Becoming a Chef or something like that. And that's just for lack of a better term, really, because, being a chef, it's just, it takes a lifetime of work. Even when you become a chef, it's just, work. And constantly just working towards your goals. When you achieve those goals, finding new ones and achieving those. So it's a pretty broad topic that, I mean, we could do an entire podcast series on. However, I had a question from a guy named Michael over in Poland. Can you believe that? They actually listen to me in Poland. And what's up, Michael? Thanks for your question. And so I wanted to read his question, which is a bit long, so bear with me. But I was getting ready to respond to his email, and I thought to myself, there's a lot of other people that are just like Michael in Michael's position. And, his question could possibly help quite a few of people out there. So Michael says, "Hi, I've been cooking daily for about 20 years with passion and made a lot of special dinners for my friends with good or worse results. Now, in about 2 months, I am going to be a chef in a restaurant. I know there is a long, long way from being a good home cook to professional chef. Can you tell me what I should practice in a restaurant kitchen? I can imagine that being able to serve any dish at any time of the day from par-cooked stuff instead of preparing the whole dish at once makes a big difference, as well as cooking much higher volume quantities of food than in a home kitchen. You've shown how to par-cook a batch of risotto and some blanched vegetables, but didn't explain what's the deal with the mashed potatoes, polenta, pasta, etc. Of course, I can make it up by myself, keeping in the bain-marie, par-cook, all that sort of stuff. But I am interested in the best way to do it. We are going to have a cold buffet with terrines, tart, charcuterie, sourdough, etc. Another question is about the oven combo, which seems to be a must-have." He's talking about the steam oven combo's device in a polished restaurant kitchen. "You don't mention using it in a professional kitchen, but I guess it helps a lot. I need it because I'm going to be steaming big batches of yeast buns. I still can't believe that there's a guy somewhere on the other side of the globe ready to help me to become a better cook. My English is not good enough to express how much I appreciate that. You're a great man, Michael." Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate you and appreciate your comments. So let's get into this. As far as, basically a crash course in becoming a chef, which, again, it's just, there's just no end to it. There's, this is a very broad topic. But there's a couple of things that I want to touch on in this podcast. And if you're not interested in ever becoming a chef, you might want to just stop now because, this is all done in one straight recording. I'm not going to edit myself because I want Michael to get a real feel of my thoughts and opinions behind some of these topics. But you may be interested as well in kind of getting into my head and getting into the mind of a chef. And that's an important point, too, in the sense that, I'm just one guy. I pay my bills by being an executive chef of a fine dining restaurant. So, I'm just one guy doing it, out of, many, many people out there that are doing this for a living. So really all I can do is give you my perspective. But, I have been fairly successful with my restaurant concept. So I'm just going to kind of give you what I feel has made a difference to me. But before we get into that, let's first hit the question of the combination of it, because the rest of this podcast is going to be all about, tips for being a chef and what you need to do when you are a chef. But the combi ovens, or the combination ovens, combine steam and dry heat. And so you have various companies that make it. The most popular one is Rationale. You also have like the CVAP, which has their cook and hold. So Rationale, CVAP, Alto Sham also does combination ovens. And this allows you to do some very precise cooking techniques where you're combining steam with moist air. And you know, you can do everything from baking awesome bread to, you know, doing bagless sous vide. There's all sorts of things that you can actually do with this technology. Now, specifically in the bun recipe that you linked to me, you can, you know, those look just like steam buns that may or may not be finished in the oven. So a regular steamer will do this because the combination ovens are pretty expensive. You know, I mean, the larger ones will cost you $20,000 to $30,000. So, Ben, do you want to get in on this conversation? We're giving tips on being an executive chef.
Sure. Yeah.
You wanna hop on in here?
Yeah. Sure.
Give me 1 second. Yeah. Again, kidnapping my chef de cuisine, Ben, who's my right hand man, and it's funny. I'm lucky because, you know, he works for me, and he was an executive chef once as well. So having a right-hand man who works in the capacity underneath me is just extremely helpful in so many ways, you know, because he's been there, done that. You got anything in your headphones there, Ben? How about now?
No, I do.
Okay. Let's see. I got to figure out what mic Ben's on. This was completely unplanned, so give me a check.
Check.
Okay, there we go. I think we got you.
All right,
so this is Michael over in Poland, and basically he's been, you know, cooking at home, doing dinner parties, all that sort of fun stuff for a long period of time, and he's going to be opening up a restaurant and a food truck.
Oh, nice.
And he wanted some... Yeah, can you believe people actually out there in Poland are visiting Stella Culinary? And
that's good. Cool. Well, I mean, one of the first times I ever read Stella Culinary, the forums, it was a guy from Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay.
Yeah, I mean,
people from all over the world.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, you know, the reach that we sometimes have. And so we're really happy to help. So I just explained to him the combination ovens, the combi steam ovens.
Okay.
And how it's going to work. Because he had a question on that. But his larger question was on being a professional chef. But just to recap real quick before we move on the combi ovens, and you guys will have to excuse us. You know, this is after a busy dinner service night, so I'm going to have people coming in and out of my office. We may or may not kidnap them to talk on the mic, but so you might hear some background noise, and I do apologize for that in advance. But so I was just talking to a friend the other day about, you know, using a combi oven in his kitchen and the production capabilities of it, because you can use it as a steamer, you can use it as a bagless sous vide where you're cooking things at very precise temperatures. And the larger units have floor drains in them, so they're like big, you know, stand-on-the-ground floor drain units. So if you're steaming a bunch of vegetables to prep those, you can, you know, set them at the highest setting in the steam, saturate that with the steam, ice them down directly into your perforated hotel pans, take the hose, melt the ice with the hose, it all drains away. I mean, you're good to go. You can do slow roasts of meat. So the combi ovens, as far as production, are incredibly useful and incredibly versatile in what you can do, again, from bagless sous vide, blanching vegetables, vegetable prep, baking some awesome bread, but they are quite expensive. You know, again, the floor units that we're talking about here, the Rationale combi ovens, I think their biggest unit is $30,000. And then I think you can get like a sub $20,000 unit, you know, that's smaller. But it all depends upon how much business you're doing and what your volume levels are. But they're amazing for prep. You can do all sorts of stuff. So now let's move on to becoming a chef and what you need to know to be a chef. And, you know, chef means chief. And that's basically you're the head, you're the leader. And that's an important designation. But one thing I will say, and Ben will attest to this, is before that, and this is something that I preach all the time, if you ask me what makes a restaurant successful, you know, there's people out there that will write, you know, papers on what makes a restaurant successful, you know?
Consistency.
Yep. That's the one word answer that I always give, consistency. And it really strips away everything else and shows you that single-minded focus that you need to be a successful chef and a successful restaurateur. Consistency. That's, you know, I don't know if you guys, I'm sure they have McDonald's in Poland, right?
Oh, yeah, they got McDonald's probably in every country in the entire world.
I would think so. I remember when I was in China, you know, we were, you know, on this tour eating Chinese food for forever. And we roll up, and there's a McDonald's, like, right next to the airport in Beijing. And we just beeline it, like all of us just beeline it. We're just like eating like, you know, like three orders of fries a piece, you know, and we loved it. And what's crazy about that is those McDonald's French fries over in Beijing tasted exactly the same as McDonald's French fries that I had at multiple locations in the United States.
Yeah, and I don't want to go off on tangents, but, you know, I was reading an article about different McDonald's around the world and just the variety of stuff that they serve. Mm-hmm. Like it was pretty cool, you know, from country to country. They really catered to, you know, the ethnic food.
Well, and that's a really important point, too, because even McDonald's, where they have a very set and stringent menu that's set by corporate, they understand that they have to be able to serve their marketplace, you know? So they're going to be offering certain items in certain locations that are going to draw in that local market, which is important. You know, you can't forsake your local market, and that's... You know, that's another thing. You know, you have to look at, you know, who is in your area, who's going to be coming to your restaurant. You know, who are the people that you are connecting with your food.
And that's why Ronald McDonald is a trillionaire.
Well, Ronald McDonald's not real,
I know that. You know, you know what I mean.
But yeah, it all circles back to consistency. Now we can sit here and debate whether or not McDonald's is an awesome restaurant, or whether or not their fries are good, or whether or not their burgers are good, and that's completely all fine and well, and we can have that discussion.
But every time you go to a McDonald's, it's the exact same thing.
Yep.
And you know exactly what you're getting.
Yep. So every dollar that you spend with McDonald's, you know exactly what you're going to get for that dollar. And nothing will shut down a restaurant faster than when somebody comes in and they have a really great meal. And then they tell their friends, they bring their friends back, and they're just eating with their friends, and the food's mediocre, and the recipe doesn't taste the same, the dish doesn't look the same, and now they're embarrassed in front of their friends, and now they can't trust you. And if they can't trust you with food that they're putting in their mouth and ingesting into their body, they're not going to come back. That's bottom line.
Yeah, and that's, you know, one of the qualities of an executive chef is making your cooks do, you know, the same thing every single time.
Yep. It's
the same flavors, the same salt, the same... amount of butter, you know, consistency is 100% key.
And always, always, always tasting. You always taste. You know, I've made certain dishes 1,000 times over. And what do? Right before we finish that dish, we give it a taste. We taste the sauce. We taste the components. When I'm walking through my kitchen, I'll randomly taste things off of my cook stations. And the way that we have the restaurant set up at Stella too, and you know, this will vary depending upon your concept, but we're a higher end concept, so I need to be able to make sure that I'm checking every single plate as it goes out. And I got guys that have been with me for years that I trust very much to produce amazing food, but I'm still looking at every single plate that goes out of my kitchen, and I have my kitchen set up to where all the plates funnel to what we call the pass, which is where the finished plates are put. And right before the servers pick them up, I'm wiping those rims, making sure they look clean, making sure all the components are there, visually looking at the sauces and the sear on the meats. And again, that leads to consistency, because bottom line, as much as I trust my cooks, at the end of the day, I need to realize that it's my name on the menu. And yes, I can't do it by myself, but... it's my name and it's my reputation on the line. And in this industry, that's all you have is your reputation.
And I give you a good plate every single time.
He does. Absolutely. I've never sent a plate back to Ben. And consistency is, you know, the key part of consistency is execution. You have to be able to execute. So it doesn't matter how awesome your recipe for one is. You may have this awesome recipe that you're making at home for your family and friends, and they love you for it, and they're telling you, oh, Michael, you got to go and, you know, open up your own restaurant because this recipe is awesome. But you're doing that recipe for 4 people. You're doing it for 6 people. Can you do it for 100? Can you do it day in and day out every single time? Can you teach a cook how to do it so you can free yourself up to do other important works of an executive chef? Of the leader of a restaurant? Can you teach your cooks how to create that dish and how to execute it, not on your slowest night of the week when it's going to be perfect, but on your busiest night of the week over and over and time again? And execution is a major, major part of consistency.
And that brings up a point for me. Like, teaching is very key in a kitchen. You know, you want to surround yourself with people that want to learn and you know, want to execute well, mm-hmm. and you teaching them and keeping in an educational setting, you know, ends up being, you know, better execution, better loyalty. Teaching is key in a kitchen.
Yeah, absolutely. And, and not only is it key for, you know, a kitchen environment, but also teaching and education is key for the chef as a leader. I mean, you have to lead by example. But one of the things that I do when I'm doing hiring interviews and, I'm interviewing potential cooks, I don't even care if it's a dishwasher. I ask them all the same thing. And it's a pretty standard question, but it's very important in the context of kitchens. And I ask them, what do you want? Why do you want to work for me? And what I'm looking for, the answer that I'm looking for, and sometimes they know the answer I'm looking for, they might try and BS me, but I can kind of usually pick that out too,
yeah.
is I need, when I'm hiring you as a cook, you know, I want you to want to be a chef one day. Because that I can work with.
Yeah. I always ask about what goals do you want to mm-hmm. achieve? And that, you know, that's a good person if they list their goals of you know, what they want to achieve. And yeah. then you can guide them there.
Well, absolutely. So, because here's the thing is, no matter how good you are in this industry, you will almost never make what you're worth as far as the amount of talent that you have, the amount of knowledge that you have, the time that you put into it, the sacrifice you put into the time away from your family and your friends, all the ongoing education that you have to do yourself. In other industries, you get to a point where if you're at the top of your industry, you're making really good money. And not even like the top. Let's say, you know, you're the top 20th or the top 10th percentile. And with cooks, you know, I can't pay cooks enough for how hard they need to work to make my restaurant great. So one of the benefits that I give them is education. But to educate somebody, they need to first care and have an end goal. And their end goal needs to be to become a chef one day and to run their own restaurant. And they need to have that goal for themselves, because then I can give them massive value. It's like, hey, I'm not only giving you a paycheck every month and giving you health benefits, but I'm giving you an education. I'm teaching you the skills that you need. You know, when you start my garde manger and you work your way up my line, you're my lead line cook, you become my sous chef, I'm teaching you the skills that you need to run your own shop one day.
I couldn't agree more.
But if they don't have that, if they don't have that drive and that desire, then they're going to wash out really quick. You know, and that's why for us, Ben will tell you, I mean, where's our starting point in our kitchen?
Dishwasher.
Dishwasher, exactly.
And we, you know, our garde manger guy right now, you know, came from dishwasher.
Yep.
And he's learning from scratch, and he's doing a hell of a job.
Yeah, because and sometimes it's good to have people who don't have all these preconceived notions of the industry or how the industry should be.
But they want to learn.
They want to learn. And I can, you know, I mean, a lot of times, you know, you have to unteach people before you can actually teach them. So if a cook comes to me with a bunch of bad habits already formed, and I look on their resume, I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, like I kind of know these restaurants. These restaurants are too hot. And I see them in my kitchen doing a tryout, or maybe we give them, you know, a couple week period to prove themselves. And I'm looking at them like, man, like even though this kid may want to learn, I'm going to have to break so many bad habits. I'm going to have to break so many preconceived notions that it's going to take me just 6 months to break the bad habits before I can even start teaching the good ones.
Good old Jamie.
Oh, let's not mention any names. I need a dump button for for this podcast.
Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Good thing you didn't say his real name. Excuse me. So yeah, you want to hire cooks that want to be chefs one day. You know, that's the bottom line. But you also, as a chef, you need to be an educator, because that's an important part of being a leader. You can't ask somebody to do something that you can't do. And I mean, one of the secrets to me having a pretty decent career at this stage in my life is the fact that I dedicated early on to becoming an educator and becoming a teacher. And I started the Free Culinary School podcast, which later got morphed into StellaCulinary.com. And, you know, I was told early on before I even got into cooking, if you ever want to really master something, you have to teach it. Because there's certain concepts that as a cook or as a chef, you know that they work, you know, you understand how to do them, but you don't understand the finer details. And when you teach somebody something, they ask you why. Why do you do it like that? You know, why is it done like this? And having that deeper understanding is, it's going to open up so many doors. I mean, just look at, you know, so brining. Brining is a good example. I did a really geeky food science video on brining about 2 years ago now.
Okay.
That talks all about brining and the science behind it. And, you know, we use dry brines, we use wet brines in our kitchen. And it took me about 40 hours of research to produce those brining videos. And up until that point, I'd used brines in my kitchen plenty of times. I understood how they worked on a basic level and how they could enhance meats. But then when I actually did the research to teach it to somebody else, because I wanted to make sure that I was giving them the proper information, then I truly understood brines. And then when I published that content, I got asked a ton of questions about the brines. So it made me think of it from the perspective of everybody else, you know, asking me those questions who maybe I didn't explain a point good enough. So I had to go back and re-explain it. And that just reinforced my information. And now we utilize the science behind brining all the time in our kitchen and get great results. And those results are specifically from me learning about brines and then teaching them to somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I did in college is, you know, the classes that I liked, I'd tutor people,
mm-hmm.
you know, and teaching is a key element because it makes you understand, have to understand a lot deeper, you know, and that's the same application in the kitchen, you know.
And teaching, too, will, like we said, will give value to your cooks because in restaurants, because of profit margins, you know, you can't pay cooks an amazing salary. I mean, as much as you want to, it's not going to pencil. You know, and the way that you give them value beyond their salary is by educating them and giving them skills that they can take on to their next place. So when, you know, and your goal should be that when any one of your employees moves on from your restaurant, they move on to a higher level. And the reason why they're moving on, unless you fire them because they just can't cut it, but the reason why they are willingly moving on is because they have the opportunity to go on and be better and take that next level up. And one of the issues that I'm very proud of at Stella is I have so many very talented people working for me that are so great at their jobs that and because of that, because we're such a tight-knit team, we don't have the turnover of a normal restaurant. People stick around for a long time, so the people who are leaving, they're like, yeah, well, you know, I want to be a sous chef or I want to be an executive chef, but I know Ben's not going to go anywhere and I know you're not going anywhere, chef. So, you know, I got an offer for a chef gig here and I want to take it because I know I can do it. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely you can do that. And I'm proud of you and I'm happy that you can do that. And that's part of, you know, your legacy that you set up as a chef. You know, people.
Yeah, I mean, we graduated a couple executive chefs within the last year.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I had a junior sous chef and a sous chef. They both left Stella and they both became executive chefs, their first gigs from Stella. And, you know, that's not to toot our own horn, but what we're saying is, you know, you as a chef, you need to give that value to your employees.
Oh, definitely.
Because they are working way too hard for the amount of money that you can pay them. And the thing is as a chef, when I get a new employee, I have to put so much of my personal time and attention into training them, or maybe not even myself. Maybe Ben does it. You know, maybe Ben, you know, is the guy who is training my next garde manger. But Ben's time is valued to me as well. You know, so we spend so much of our personal time training people that, you know, we don't want people to come in and I'd be like, okay, cool, done. I learned that in 6 months. Now, you know, you guys have nothing new to show me. I'm going to peace out. You know, and they leave. And so, like, just when we get them to the point after 6 months where they're great employees, you know, now we have to start that cycle all over again. So the way that you maintain your employees, especially in the culinary industry, is by offering them education.
Yeah, and then you get complete loyalty.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
What kind of food trucks are you opening up?
You know, I'm not sure.
Okay.
My guess would be something Polish.
Sausage.
Makes sense. I don't know. Steam buns.
Cool. Right on.
Yeah, I'd eat it for sure.
Definitely.
So yeah, so lead by example, be an educator, be a lifelong learner. And, I'm kind of the opinion as well that every chef should have a blog or some sort of outlet online that teaches people, whether you're doing YouTube videos, whether you're doing an audio podcast like we're doing now, whether you're writing recipes or writing blog posts, on your own personal blog. And all that stuff is really simple to set up because it forces you to first educate yourself and to be a lifelong learner and then teach it to other people. And while you do that, you're also building your own personal brand. And, personal brand and your personal reputation is really what you have in this industry. I have a pretty decent resume. I haven't shown my resume in almost a decade because every single job that I've gotten and every single deal that I've made has been based purely upon my reputation and my performance. And that's...
Yep.
Yeah, and that's where the rubber meets the road. You can have the nicest resume in the world, and people hand me their resumes, I hardly even glance them. I don't know about you, Ben. You've hired a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, you could work at a dozen different great places, but you're there for 6 months, you're there for 3 months, that kind of thing. I'm glad you have that on your resume, but, it's the long-term consistency and, the recommendations from your former employer that really make or break the game.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I do actually when I do glance over a resume, I don't really care where you worked.
No, not at all.
Because I can, talking to you, I can get a pretty good sense of whether or not you're going to be a good fit for our kitchen. One thing that's a red flag though is if your resume reads like a rap sheet where like 3 months here, 2 months there, 6 months there, I was like, "Oh, this guy's a transient."
Yeah, great. I'm glad you worked at those places, but I'm not going to take you for 2 months. I need a commitment for, a while, and I want to educate you.
Well, yeah, because, in 2 months, you're not even going to be good at your job yet. Like, we're still going to be holding you up.
Yeah.
So if we wash you out in 2 months, we've spent so much time, on you. And, we've taken time out of our days, which are always there's never enough hours in a day when you're working in a restaurant. And we're taking time out of our day to try and train you and make you a better cook. And then just when you start, showing that progress, you move on. And that could be because of us. Maybe we're not doing a good working environment and maybe we're not teaching you enough. But when you see, if you're doing your best to have that positive environment where you're teaching people and you're trying to give them the skills to become a better cook, and, you have a happy working environment, you're not, one of those lunatic chefs that just crazy and awful to work for. If you're not that, one of the red flags you want to look for on a resume is,
jumping all over the place.
Exactly.
I'd rather have a guy that's worked at Applebee's for 10 years, be able to train him because I know he's going to be faithful and loyal.
Yeah, but then you might have to break a lot of bad habits. I don't,
that's true. But it's better than a guy that jumps around every 6 months.
Well, exactly. And loyalty is key in this industry, so. That's what we're looking for. Okay, so that's more like esoterical stuff. Let's kind of get down to brass tacks. So you're going to open your own restaurant and you're going to run it. So you're going to have to educate your employees and, all that stuff that we covered. Now, the next thing we need to talk about is the financial side. You got to be able to keep your costs in line. And restaurants in general, they can lose you a lot of money very quickly.
That is a really big point.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to plan before you're actually taking on this operation and figure out what your cost should be and what your percentages should be for food, for labor, for, overhead in terms of, what electricity costs and all that kind of stuff. You really need to plan that out.
Yeah. Do a budget.
Yeah.
If you're not comfortable with some form of spreadsheet software, whether it's Google Docs or Excel spreadsheet or numbers for Mac, whatever it is, if you're not comfortable with building spreadsheets, then you should probably just stop now and, go to a community college and take a class, because a major part of what I do for a living, people think I'm just in the kitchen all day long cooking recipes, and I'm not. A lot of it is...
I am.
Yeah, Ben is. Yeah, and that's... So that circles back around to the point of education. So I've been working with Ben for a long period of time, and I trust Ben to be able to, you know, to manage my prep as the chef de cuisine and make sure every single one of my cooks is on task. So when I need to go over and sit in my office and do numbers for, you know, an extended period of time and figure out where our running profitability is on that given day in that month and look at those numbers, you know, I have the ability to do that.
Yeah, the most success I've had in terms of, you know, being a chef and doing numbers is, you know, having a spreadsheet but doing it day to day, getting your percentage from day to day. You check your invoices in, you see what you made, you know, keep a labor percentage every single day.
Yep.
And, you know, you get mid-month and it gets a little high, then you got to start cutting or whatever it is. But, I mean, that is a real important thing to do, you know, as a day-to-day process.
Yeah, and so what I actually like to use here is we use Google Docs because the nice thing about Google Spreadsheets is we can link them all together. So what I do is I have our hourly timesheet is a clock-in for Google Docs, and I have all my employees clock in and clock out, and this around salary, into this Google Docs spreadsheet. And this is linked to my numbers spreadsheet that I have imported directly into my numbers Excel sheet. So the way that this works is, so I have a separate sheet where their hours are calculated and multiplied by their hourly wage, multiplied by their overtime, and it imports directly into my running P&L into my labor section for that month. So then as I get in, so I have my rent, my average electricity usage, all those overhead costs, I have them based upon an average basically a daily average, and into my overhead cost section. Then I have my hourly wages and my salary wages daily coming in and being imported into my main spreadsheet. And then I have all my food cost numbers coming in. So as I pull in as we get an invoice for a new order, I plug that into the sheet. And then every single night or every two nights, I will plug in the sales that we do in the restaurant. And I'll do the not only the sales numbers, but also the cover counts, which shows me our check averages, making sure that we're on task. And what this does is it gives me a running total for the entire month. And there's certain times where I'll be like, hey, Ben, you know, we're coming up towards the end of the month. Labor's a little high. It's a couple percentage points over. You know, let's watch the hourly labor. You know, let's make sure that people aren't coming in too early or too, you know, staying too late. Our food cost is a little high. And we'll even look at, I break down all of my purveyors as well. So my produce purveyors in one section, my meat purveyors in another section, my fish guys in another section. So then I can see exactly how much money I'm spending with each person and make sure that I'm justifying it. You know, and that's super. I mean, you can't fly blind. You can't just, you know, make a dish and then look at that dish and be like, well, you know.
You know, and another point is costing out dishes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is really key. You know, let's say you have, 10 dishes on your menu or whatnot, but costing them out and figuring out the exact food cost and the exact labor that goes into it is just 100% key. You can't just say, let's just throw up a price and be like, oh, you know, I paid $15 a pound for this fish. Let's just charge 30, you know, something like that. You have to, you know, look at every component, break it down by pounds or ounces or whatever you want to do, and, you know, figure out how that matters on your food cost.
Yeah, and that's massive. I mean, as far as so just to talk about that for a second, I mean, not to get too deep because this could be a whole separate podcast episode. But no, I mean, Ben brings up a good point with food costs in your spreadsheets. And so what you want to do is you basically want to create a spreadsheet that takes your cost of your item, and you have two costs. You have your as purchase cost, and then you have your prepped cost.
Your yield cost.
Your yield. Thank you. So when we get in a beef tenderloin, you know, and we pay X amount of dollars per pound for our beef tenderloin, for our filet mignon that we're putting on the menu, we're not just taking that beef tenderloin and cutting it into filets. We have to trim it down. And that trim is a loss. So our yield cost on that filet is so our yield percentage, let's say our yield percentage is about 65 to 60%.
That's about right.
So we yield that, and then we're going to cost our fillet based upon that. So let's just say, for example, do you see my calculator on the table? Oh, it's right here.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's say, for example.
And you want to do this with almost every protein.
Not only every protein, but every single ingredient in your dish. But specifically, the proteins are what you're going to have that yield cost on.
Correct.
So I take something like, you know, so let's just pick a round number. I'm paying $15 a pound for my beef tenderloin.
Okay.
Okay, and we pulled in, and I say, well, okay, I'm getting a 16 or a 65% yield on that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to multiply that by 1.65. And that's going to give me my price per pound on that yield, which is $24.75 a pound. So then I'm doing an 8-ounce portion of that. And I'm going to divide that by 16 ounces to get my ounce cost, which is $1.15 an ounce. Multiply that by 8, and that's going to give me, you know, $12.30 for an 8-ounce fillet. So that's how much it's actually costing me to put it on the plate. But that's no profit. I haven't made any profit. I still got to pay my overhead. I still got to pay my cooks.
We got all the accompaniments for the dish.
Yeah, that's just the fillet. We haven't even talked about our sauces yet. So then you say to yourself, okay, well, now I got to run my food costs. And every single place will have a different budgeted food cost that they're looking to do, right? So let's just pick a round number. Let's say we're doing a 30% food cost. So what you want to do is you want to actually divide that by 30%. So divide $12.30 by 0.3, which is 30%. That gives me $41.25. Okay, so if I just sear a filet mignon and put it on your plate, I need to charge you $41.25 for that filet before I even give you any accompaniments. Because running a 30% food cost means that I have a 70% profit, technically speaking, but it's not my profit yet because I still have to take the rest of that 70% and I have to pay my rent, I have to pay my overhead, I have to pay my cooks. You know, my oven goes down and now I got to pay a guy to come out and fix my oven. My compressor breaks on my walk-in. Now I got to pay a guy to come out and fix the compressor on my walk-in fridge. So food cost is very important, but even more important than food cost is contribution dollars. So you'll see like guys who run like pizza restaurants and they're like, well, you know, I run a 15% food cost on my pizza. Well, it's like good for you, but you're selling your pizza for $15. So, and your rent is $4,000 a month because you're in downtown or whatever, but it's $8,000 a month because you're downtown, right? So how many $15 pizzas do you need to sell to pay your rent? You got to sell a lot of damn pizzas.
Yeah, I'm glad we went this direction.
You know, so with my filet, even if I run my filet at a higher food cost, maybe I'm running it at like a 35% food cost, because I'm selling that steak for $45.
That's paying your rent.
Yeah, I have to sell less steaks, even though I have a higher food cost percentage, I have to sell less steaks than pizzas because I have more contribution dollars to the bottom line. You know, so and that's a very important point that people miss, especially when they're doing their P&L numbers. And
yeah, I was hoping you'd go that direction because, I mean, that's a really important point.
It's massive. And you see people lose their ass on all the time. And what's even more important than that is not getting necessarily caught up in, excuse me, not getting caught up in your food cost percentage, but looking at what's called your prime cost. And your prime cost is labor plus food. And so you want to keep a running total of your labor and your food costs together as a percentage. And in general terms, if your prime cost, your labor cost plus your food cost, is above 60% of your total sales, it's time to start panicking.
Yeah.
It's time to start panicking.
50% is about a good number.
Well, it depends on your concept.
It depends on your concept. Depends if you're fine dining or if you're not, and you know that kind of thing.
Yeah, because again, you have contribution dollars. So what's interesting is, so in fine dining, the cooks are notoriously low paid Because the reason why they're cooks in a fine dining restaurant is to get their notch on their resume. So then one day they have the skills to, you know, to be a chef and to make those big bucks. Or at least that's what you that's what you trick them into thinking. So they don't quit completely. But in fine dining as well, because you're using a higher end product, you're paying more for your food. So your food cost is going to be higher, but your labor is going to be lower, especially when you calculate that against your sales. You know, so you know you get in a fine dining restaurant. I mean, so here we're not even that high end, to be quite honest with you. I mean, we're not like, you know, 2-3 Michelin star level, which, you know, you go to a 3 Michelin star restaurant, you're looking at, you know, anywhere from, you know, $290 to over $300 a head just for the food. So our check average here will range from about $85 to $95 a head. So every single person who walks through our door, we can expect them on average to pay $85 to $95 a head. So we're going to have more contribution dollars to the bottom line. Now, in lower end dining, if you're selling less expensive food, normally what you do is, because people are so price oriented, you actually make up the cost by paying your cooks a higher wage, because, you know, no one wants to work in a crappy turn. I mean, not saying your restaurant's crappy, but, you know, cooks don't aspire to go in every day and flip burgers. They just don't. I'm sorry if that's the hard truth, but they don't. So the way that you keep them around is you pay them a higher wage. You pay them a higher dollar average, but you're also making a larger percent profit on your hamburger because your food cost on a burger is very low.
True.
You know, so looking at those two numbers together, the labor cost and the food cost together, and saying, you know, that, okay, this is my prime, you know, and I don't want to go about X amount. And again, it depends upon your concept, but 60% is a pretty good baseline. If it goes higher than 60%, because then look at it this way. So if your food cost and your labor cost go above 60%, the rest of that 40%, that is where your overhead is and where your profit's at. Now, in very traditional terms, like what they'll teach you, like, so if you go to somebody who's, you know, been in the industry and they're like, how do I make money in restaurants? It's like, well, you know, you don't. You know, then you're like, no, really, how do I make money in restaurants? We're like, well, you have three costs. You have your food costs, your labor costs, and your overhead. And each one should be at 30%. So 30% food cost, 30% labor cost, 30% overhead, and you have 10% for profit at the end of the year. And the truth of the matter is if you're making 10% profit in a restaurant, you're a rock star.
Yeah, you're stoked.
You know, so a lot of fast casual places, they can make, you know, closer to 15% profit. But, you know, I mean, so that's what you're looking at. But as you change your concept, you know, I mean, you know, not one size fits all for every restaurant concept. So maybe you're, you know, in the case of like the pizza joint, your food cost is a little bit lower because you're selling people dough and cheese, which isn't that expensive. But your labor cost is a little bit higher because all the teenagers that, you know, are, you know, in high school who you're paying $11 an hour to, they don't show up for work and they, you know, they no call, no show. And so it screws your restaurant. So you got to get a couple of old timers and you got to pay them $15 an hour to come in and make sure your pizzas are right, because you got to make sure that pie is consistent. And then because you're, you know, you get to the end of the month and you're like, well, you know, I have to sell 2,000 friggin' pizzas just to pay my rent. You know, so those are the things that you need to take into consideration before you even jump into your own location and open up your own shop. You need to get a spreadsheet, and you need to start doing some realistic projections.
Yes, planning is key, both for food truck or restaurant. You don't want to get yourself in over your head. I mean, planning is definitely key. You know, we don't want you to fail.
Yeah, so I think we covered that. You know, I want to circle back around real quick though to the to the food cost, because when we were talking,
we're giving this guy good information.
Yeah, so I want to give you a better way to calculate the yield, because I think the 1.65 was actually wrong. So when we're doing yield, mm-hmm. So if we break down, so if we have 1 pound and we get a 65% yield on that, then we're dividing that by 0.65, which is 65%.
Correct.
Which, yeah, so you can divide by your yield, and that's going to give you the number that you want. So again, so let's say $10 a pound, you get a 65% yield on it. I'm going to divide 10 by 0.65. So now that product that cost me $10 a pound is actually costing me $15 a pound, or well, 15.38.
Well, you can do it either way. So, I mean, whatever you're comfortable doing.
Yeah, so I didn't want to confuse him on that. So you have to so in your spreadsheet, you have to figure out your yield cost first, how much each ingredient costs you to put on the plate. Because just because you pay a certain price for it, like even carrots, you know, you peel down your carrots, you're losing something. You know, we're not serving carrot tops, we're serving the carrot centers when we're slicing them on a bias. So you need to weigh that stuff. Now, here's the thing, though. We get a 60% yield on our fillet of beef, and we're passing that on to our customers so we can hit our food cost. But you are nuts if you think that we're taking all that trim, that scrap, and throwing it in our trash.
No, that's a good point to bring up.
Not even close. What makes us money, and I will put my food cost up against anybody, what makes us money is our use of waste product, our use of scrap. And that's the most important thing. So those trimmings that you get from that product that you bring in, you need, and that's where, because here's the deal. A filet mignon, that's simpleton work. It really is. Like, don't overcook it.
Pretty much.
You know, like, if you can serve a filet mignon mid-rare, you're fine. You're good. People are going to pay their money for it. They're going to eat it. They're going to be happy. They're going to walk away. That's it, right? But the true sign of a great chef and a great cook is being able to take all that scrap that other lesser chefs would throw into the trash and figure out how to make it a great dish that people are willing to spend money on. And not only spend money on, but love it.
Yeah, and I take the perfect example of, we used to do ducks here. You know, so we'd take the breasts and we'd, you know, butcher the whole duck or whatnot. And we'd take the breasts and that's what would be on our main entree. We'd sous vide it and crisp it up. We'd take the leg and thigh, we'd confit it, use it on a different dish. We'd take the innards and use it to make pate, and then we take the bones and make a great duck stock with it, you know, and there's a 0% waste there, and you're basically helping out three different dishes on one duck.
And you got to be able to mask your product usage, your product cross-utilization, so people aren't getting bored with your menu. But so Ben brought up a very good point. So with the duck, we would order in a case of duck, and it's six ducks per case. And depending upon the size of the ducks, but it would average right around $100 per case. So we'd pay $100 for six ducks. And that $100 would basically give us, I think I need you to go check on next door real quick.
Sounds good.
And just make sure they're all on task.
I'll be back.
Ben will be back, but he doesn't need me to tell you, or I don't need him to tell you. He's heard this talk before. That's what I'm trying to say. So you have your six ducks at $100, right? And then for those six ducks, you're getting 12 breasts. And, you know, we would sell those 12 breasts for about, you know, $33 a piece as an entree. But here was the trick, is we had our signature pate appetizer on our menu. And we would do all the innards from our ducks. We would take those and we'd create our pate with it. And we have a video recipe for this on stellacolony.com. If you go to stellacolony.com/HCC, which stands for house cured charcuterie. So stellacolony.com/HCC, you'll see our pate recipe. And for every six ducks I got, I was able to yield one terrine mold. And for every tureen mold that I got, I was able to get minimum 20 orders of duck pate that I would sell for $12 a pop. So that's $240 right there off of just the guts, the innards. So the hearts, the gizzards, the livers, all that. So even if you're using the legs to make confit and you're using the bodies to make stock, a lot of times people are just taking those innards out and they're dropping them in the trash because they don't want to deal with it. And the thing is to make an awesome pate, it's very technical. Searing and crisping a duck breast isn't nearly as hard as making an awesome pate that people are willing to spend $12 an order on. But not only was our pate wildly popular, it paid for our ducks more than twice over. So again, for every duck that I got in, or for every case of ducks that I got in that I spent $100 on, I would make $240 off of just the guts. So every single breast that I put on the plate, I had already paid for twice just with the money that came in from that pate. And the main component on that dish was the actual pate itself. We do a little salad. We do little crostinis. It really cost us next to nothing to produce. And that was allowing us to place that duck breast on our menu and keep our food costs much lower. Same thing with our salmon that we've done in the past. You buy in whole salmon, trim the salmon, the center loin cuts go to your fillets, which you know are your entree portions. Then all the scrap goes into our rillettes, and we sell salmon rillettes. We sell smoked salmon pate. We do salmon raviolis. And again, we're taking all this scrap that you would normally just throw in the trash because it's trimmings, and we're turning it into items that generate revenue for us. And really, one of the things that I learned early on as a chef is, especially when you're working with proteins, is you want to always have a strategy to make the scrap from your proteins at the very minimum pay for the hard cost of your protein. So if I'm selling a filet mignon on my menu, I'm doing beef tartare, I'm grinding it up and making lettuce wraps with it. And by the time I sell all of those, I'm more than paying for my initial investment in that hard cost. But the thing is too, I'm not a big fan of what are called loss leaders. So just because I'm paying for my hard cost for my filet doesn't mean I'm going to sell my filet for cheaper. And you may have a different strategy. But my thing is look at like most other people are charging the same price for their filet as I am, and they're throwing their stuff in the trash, you know, because they still have to hit their 28% food cost or whatever it is that they budgeted at. So all the other stuff is just bonus money on top, you know. So I want to pay for the hard cost of my protein items, because those are the most expensive things on your menu. I want to pay for those with all of my trimmings. And so we turn those into appetizers. We turn those into specials. And here's the thing is you can't screw with your customers. People loved our lettuce wraps. Why? Because we put a ton of love and care into them. People loved our duck pate because we took it seriously. We are indeed that recipe. I mean, I personally are indeed my own duck pate recipe for 3 years before I got to where I wanted it to be. You know, so you can't just say like, oh, well, here, chump, you know, here's a $12 appetizer with all of our scrap on it. Like, people aren't stupid. They can see that. And, you know, you as a chef, you need to realize that you can't ever lie to yourself. And you can never think that someone knows less than you do. So you have to assume that everybody sitting in your dining room knows more about food and knows more about restaurant, knows more about cooking and food costs than you do. And so that way, so then you project yourself into their seat. And if I sat down in my restaurant and I ordered the pate and I saw a duck breast on the menu and I ate the pate, I'd be like, well, damn, that's a really good pate. And this is a smart chef for using all of those guts and buying in the whole animal and cross utilizing that product to pay for his duck breast. But on the same account, if I sat down and that pate that you gave me was half-assed, I would hate you for it. I'd be like, oh, he's just trying to pass off his scrap to me.
Yeah, you got to make, you know, every component of what you're breaking down, whatever, you know, dishes you're doing with various components of a duck or a filet or that kind of thing. You got to make it the best you got.
One of the scariest things about being a chef is when you're a chef, you no longer have somebody above you to tell you whether you're right or wrong. And that's scary. So I try and, you know, I'll ask my cook's opinions, because the reason why they work for me is because I trust them and I trust their palates, and especially once we've worked together for a long time. So I'm always asking Ben, hey, Ben, taste this. What do you think? Hey, Alex, taste this. What do you think? You know, and I really value their feedback on it. But there's times where you go into the kitchen and you have this, you know, like all, you know, I'll dream of a dish and I'll wake up and I'll be in the shower, like thinking of a dish and be like, oh, that is such a great idea. And then I'll go into the kitchen and I'll start R&D on that dish and I'll start cooking it. And I'm putting all the products together and just, you know, put hours and hours. And I'll spend, you know, 3 days, 4 days, sometimes weeks on a single dish. And then I get ready for, and I'm so excited about this dish and it's showtime. And I plate it up and I put all the components together. And I taste it. And it's not that good. And all I want to do is lie to myself and say, no, it's good.
Yeah, I put this thought into it. Yeah. It's got to be good.
Come on, Jacob. You put all this time and effort into this dish. How can it not be good? And you want to, like, you want to trick yourself into saying, no, it's really good.
No, you got to stay objective and have, you know, people with you to taste the same thing.
Absolutely. And as a chef, you don't have a chef above you to go to and say, hey, is this okay? Does this taste good? So the first time you're going to get feedback on that dish, what's that buzzing noise?
I don't know. That's what I was kind of wondering.
Well, I hope it's not a bomb. So the first time you get feedback on that dish is going to be a customer complaining. Somebody who's paying money. And they're going to be like, oh, this dish sucks. I don't like it at all. Or they're not going to say anything to you. And they're going to go on a review site. And they're going to talk about what a horrible chef you are.
Or they just won't come back, period. And they'll tell their friends not to come back.
And they'll tell their friends not to come back.
So a perfect example for us is Lupe is our pastry chef. And, he puts up, you know, great desserts all the time. But each and every one of us taste it, you know, and if there's something that needs to be critiqued, we'll do it until it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But every single one of us tastes it and gives our opinion. And, you know, we kind of go from there.
Well, and that's an important culture to have because, I mean, Lupe has been with us for a very long time. And I mean, he's been here longer than Ben. And Lupe is a great pastry chef. And I remember, when he first got here, he was actually talking to my old sous chef. And he says, he tells him, you know, I don't think Chef Jacob likes me that much. Like, because everything that I give him to taste, like he always critiques it and tells me that it's wrong. And my old sous chef's like, no, don't take it personal. It's just, if chef doesn't think it's absolutely perfect, if he doesn't think it's the best that it can be, then it's not going on the menu. And that's just it, you know, and I went through that myself as a cook, coming up.
Everybody has.
But, you know, I really had that, oh shit moment when I first became a chef and that first time I saw my name on a menu that I had written and I was just like, and I hadn't served it to my customers yet, you know, it was my first menu. And I just like, I hope they like it. I didn't have anybody above me to say, hey, you know, chef, what do you think? What's your opinion? Does this taste good? You know, so that's why I've always been, you know, a big advocate for getting people together and creating an environment of trust to where it's like, no. I don't want you to tell me how good I am. You know, I don't need you to stroke my ego as my cook or as my sous chef or my chef de cuisine.
Objective opinion.
Yeah, and sometimes it's hard to take. And even if, you know, like, you know, Alex or Ben, they'll be like, yeah, you know, maybe a little more ass or maybe a little more this or, you know, maybe it went a little too long in the sous vide. I'm kind of tasting these sort of textures. And you see all of that stuff. And if you were really honest with yourself, a lot of times you could pick that stuff up before anybody else tastes it. But again, all that work and all that effort that went into it. And quite honestly, sometimes your dish is just going to be a complete failure and you have to start from scratch again.
And we've done that plenty of times.
All the time.
Yeah, and it just is what it is.
You know, I mean, nothing's more frustrating to me when, and, you know, frustrating might not be the right word, but it's always kind of an interesting dynamic when we spend so much time on creating a dish, going through an R&D process, you know, tweaking all the components. I mean, some dishes, you know, we'll spend a couple of months on, and we finally put on the menu. People come in, they eat it, and they love it. And then they say, you know, and then they come back again and they eat it and they love it. And then they come back the third time and like, okay, so what's next? What's new? And you're like,
well, I can only do so much at once.
Do you know how long it took me to make this dish that you like so much? And now like, I'm working on it, but
you want like, something else? It's going to take me another month.
Yeah. I mean, it's always nice to be, you know, because people just think that we come in and we're just like, yeah, we're amazing cooks and we're going to make this dish and just, you know, pulling stuff out of the walk-in and that's that, you know, we're done. And it's not the case. I mean, every single dish that is worth mentioning on my menu that we talk about as Stella Classics, every single one of those dish, not one was perfect the first time we made it.
Not at all.
Not one. Every single dish had something wrong with it. From when we conceptualized it to when we put it on the plate and we thought it was going to be awesome and we tasted it, every single one had something that could make it better.
Yeah, and we, you know, once you put it on the menu, you know, we've done this in a couple of cases, you just kind of, you morph it a little bit and just continue to make it better. You know, it starts out as a great dish, you know, but if it's on your menu for 6 months, you're continually like, tweaking it, you know.
Yep.
Adding a crunching component, add more acid, that kind of thing, or whatever it is. And, you know, it's continually getting better even though it's on the menu.
Yeah, that's that's a good point, too. I mean, sometimes, I mean, look, you want to be able to serve a good dish, but perfection is never achieved in a kitchen. There's always something that you can do better. So it's like this point that you're always getting closer and closer and closer to, but you're never going to truly achieve. But, you know, sometimes, quite frankly, good enough is good enough. We'll create a dish and we'll taste it and be like, yeah, it's a solid dish. We're going to charge this much for it. People are going to be happy to pay that much for it because it's worth that price. And it's a good dish. May not be the best duck dish in the world, but we're not the best chefs in the world. So that's okay. You know, it's a solid dish. But then as it goes on our menu, we start to work out the kinks and we start to get inspired and we start to get bored by some of the components. And like, hey, well, what if we do this? And what if we do that? So we're constantly, you know, going through and refining that dish until we reach a point where it's not perfect, but it's as good as we can get it at that time and place.
Great point.
And that's something important too, where, you know, you got to look at your time and place of where you're at. I'm proud of every dish that I've ever served at Stella. And the Stella of 5 years ago, when I first started here, that people would come in, they'd pay their money and they enjoyed us. And they've been, you know, a lot of them have been customers for the past 5 years, keep on coming back. The Stella of now would crush the Stella of 5 years ago.
Because yeah, it's been a good evolution.
It's been a great evolution because I wasn't as good of a chef 5 years ago. I didn't have as strong as a team 5 years ago. And I didn't have as strong as a clientele 5 years ago to where now like we've built up so much trust with our clientele. We can really let loose and basically cook whatever we want, whatever we're inspired by and that we're passionate about. Exactly. And our clientele is along for the ride. So we can be our truest sense, which I think allows us to make our best food. So the thing is you have to realize that nothing's ever going to be perfect. And you can always progress past your station in life at that point. I mean, that's what being a lifelong learner and that's what always constantly trying to be better is all about. But the thing is you have to be able to be proud of the dish that you're serving and stand behind the dish that you're serving right now. And just be like, this is the best dish that I can possibly serve at this moment in time.
And educate your cooks to do it consistently.
Yep. Consistency is key. So one more thing before we go.
We're giving this guy like a 101. I know, right?
So one thing I want to touch on, which I think is important and doesn't get discussed enough. If you listen to the Free Culinary School podcast, or you listen to the Stella Culinary School podcast, I always finish it with saying, and this is Jacob Burton from the Stella Culinary School podcast, reminding you to always cook with passion. And it's, you know, it's true and it's a bit of a cheesy tagline. I mean, it's just, you know, it is what it is. And I think, you know, because that's what got me into cooking in the first place is being passionate. And people can taste the passion and the love that you put into your food. But after doing this for quite some time now, if I could go back and change that tagline, I wouldn't say cook with passion. I would say, especially to the professional cooks, I would say cook with dedication. And this is an important point that Thomas Keller made in one of his, he gave a lecture at, it's like the Google campus.
Oh, okay.
And he was, it was very fascinating. I'll try and find a link and throw it up in the show notes of this episode. But what he's talking about is passion is what gets you involved. I'm passionate about cooking. I'm passionate about wanting to be a chef. I have this dream of being this great chef one day. Just like when you meet your significant other. Oh, I'm so passionate about this person. I love this person. But really, like, where your love is tested is not when things are perfect, but when they're not perfect.
Yep.
And what you need to do is you need to be able to like log that passion, that initial beginner passion. Lock that into your brain and be able to remember that. Be able to remember why you started on this path in the first place. Because this is a really hard industry. It takes a lot of time, a lot of sacrifice, constant learning, and it's never, ever done with. It's never done with. You can always learn more.
There's always something.
You can always be better. You come in feeling great. You know, you're all hyped up, and all of a sudden a stove's down, and a cook's calling in sick, and someone's giving you notice, and there's always something in this industry. And what will make you a great chef or a great restaurateur or a great cook is the ability to dedicate yourself to that path of greatness. Being able to remember that passion that you had at the beginning when you first started. Because I have fallen in and out of love with this industry many, many times.
Me too.
It's a rough industry.
I mean, what have you been, 15 years? About that? Or years.
Yeah, about 12 years.
I've been 15.
Yeah.
Yeah, you love it and you hate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it's like...
But you got to remember exactly where you started at.
You know, I mean,
why you did it.
There's certain nights where, like, things are firing great and we get people walking into the kitchen and just saying, oh, we love you guys so much, you know, and shaking our hands, wanting to take pictures with us. And at that moment, because you're getting that feedback, that immediate feedback, like you feel like rock stars and you feel awesome and you're on this high and then you feel like you're untouchable and you come into work the next day. And then, you know, Murphy's Law always applies in restaurants.
Always.
Always. Murphy was a chef.
If you're low on something, they're going to order it.
Oh, man. We need to make T-shirts that say Murphy was a chef. And about two people would actually understand, but that's okay. So we'll sell our two, and we'll have our little private club.
I think any cook has been a long-time cook would definitely understand that. Sorry to get off point.
No. But what we're trying to say is this industry will try you. It will test you. Don't let it get you off track, because passion is a fleeting, it's an emotion. Passion is a fleeting emotion. It will come, it will go, it will return. But what you need to do is dedicate yourself to the path of being you. Whether that's being a great chef, whether it's being a great dentist, who knows? You know, but you will be tried. And I have only worked. I mean, I had some odd jobs here and there, but my entire career, I've been a chef, so I can't talk for other careers. What I do know, though, is I see people all the time. You know, if you're a dentist, you know, who knows? Maybe you say, well, you know, the 7 or 9 years of dental school really sucks, and I really don't like, you know, smelling people's bad breath all day. But I love driving around a Porsche, you know, so this dentist thing isn't all bad. But the difference is when you're a cook, a lot of times when you interview, especially young cooks or new cooks, what do they say? Oh, chef, I'm so passionate. I just love cooking. I'm so passionate about being a cook. I just want to be a great chef one day.
Prove it to me.
Exactly. And that's the difference, is because passion is an emotion, then that emotion can very quickly be changed, because it's all about a state of mind, right? It's you're passionate one day because you love being in a kitchen and you love the fulfillment that being a chef can give you or being a cook can give you, but then it all comes crashing down. And then where you're at? Are you going to give up all of your hard work that you've done over the years just because that fleeting emotion of passion has finally left you? Or are you going to remember the dedication that you made to your path to be the best that you can be? join the army.
Couldn't have, you couldn't have said it better, though. I mean, this is industry where passion has, you know, you have to set a path for yourself and you have to stick, you know, stick to it, be dedicated to it. You know, it's not an easy industry to work in by any stretch of the imagination. But once you set your path, once you're determined that, you know, I'm going to do this, I'm going to work up and be a chef. Once I'm a chef, I'm going to be successful. You know, you just put your mind to it, and you really have to put your mind to it.
Yeah, and if you're a stubborn person, then you're pretty much cut out for being a chef, because you'll get all these signals of, like, you know, why you should not be a chef.
Oh, my wife says that.
Exactly. And that's just one signal. You know, so you get all these signals of, like, why you shouldn't be a chef or why you shouldn't be in the industry. And quite frankly, a lot of them are very valid and good reasons. A lot of sacrifice, low pay, especially early on, missing holidays and weekends with your family and friends. When everyone else is having a good time on the weekends and on holidays, you're the person in the back cooking their food and serving it to them. So all these very logical reasons to not be a part of the industry. So being stubborn, you're like, no. I'm going to show these people that I truly was born to be a chef. And I have dedicated myself to be a chef, and I'm going to prove them wrong because I'm going to just keep on being a chef.
Now, I'm going to make a little bit light of this, but, you know, Alex, our sous chef, he says you have to be a special kind of stupid to do this kind of stuff. You know, but, it, you know, it's a little bit true. Like, but you have to be dedicated, but you have to, you know, make many sacrifices in this industry, you know, especially holiday and family and that kind of thing. You know, it's hard for all of us, but, you know, that's our passion, and you keep on that road.
And that's why chefs make awesome friends, because number one, we can always cook really good for you. Number two, we'll stand up with you drink for drink. You know, we're never going to go to bed early. We're always down for hanging out. And number three, we're not quite as smart as you, because if we were, we'd probably do what you're doing for a living.
Yeah, but we're passionate about what we do.
Yeah. And and number four, we're loyal.
Yeah.
And that's what keeps us on the track, is we're not only are we passionate about what we do, but we're dedicated to what we do, and we are a community. And that's why, Michael, you sending me this email turned into a very long discussion. I warned people over an hour ago that this was going to be a long discussion. But I felt compelled to do this audio recording for you, this podcast for you, to pull Ben in on it, because we are a community as professional cooks. We are a community, and you know, so anything that I can do to help you or anyone else out there, whether you're just a passionate home cook who just loves making amazing meals for your family and friends, or if you're looking to make that next step up in your career, you know. As cooks, we need to stick together. You know,
that's true.
It's all about community.
So, and then my last advice, if we're going to close this out, you know, was it Michael?
Yeah.
It's, you know, build a loyal family around you.
Yeah.
You know, for us, there's five of us, but we see each other more than we see any other person in our life. And we're very loyal to each other. We know, you know, all the ins and outs. But that creates a great kitchen environment. You know, it's just kind of the way to go. You know, even if you have a larger kitchen and, you know, you're opening up something big, you know, you need people that are just loyal and committed, you know, and that's who you want to hire and surround yourself with. And that's going to make you successful.
I think that's a great place to end.
Cool.
Thank you for that, Ben.
Yep.
And thanks for your time.
Yep.
Oh, and one last thing before we go. I know I didn't really address your issue on the holding of the starches, but just in general, so things like polenta and mashed potatoes, you want to make those fresh before service, and then hold those in a steam table, either in like a bain-marie or just, you know, keeping them warm during service. The risotto you can par cook and then finish to order. So a lot of the execution steps for a busy restaurant is figuring out, you know, what things you can prep ahead. You know, we constantly are blanching our vegetables ahead of time. Obviously, we're not blanching vegetables in order, so in that way, we can just saute them. Sous vide is a big part of our workflow, where we're going to cook the meat sous vide, chill them down, hold them in the vacuum pack. Then when we get an order, we'll drop those individual vacuum pack proteins into the circulator to bring them back. So it really depends upon your strategy. So, Mike, if you have any follow-up questions as far as, you know, specifically tell us what kind of recipes you're planning on cooking and what kind of dishes you're planning on serving and where your pitfalls are as far as, like, issues you're having with execution, getting them out in a timely fashion, making them consistent. You know, that's what we're here for. We are here to help you. Again, we are all one community. But really just figuring out how you can make the execution as streamlined as possible so you're getting out a consistent product in a timely fashion. And that's it for this episode of Ask Chef Jacob, found online at askchefjacob.com. If you want to submit a question via email, just send it to me, jacob@stellaculinary.com. Or you can go to askchefjacob.com, a Stella Culinary page, and just record an audio question there. Sign up for our email newsletter if you haven't yet. And until next time, always cook with dedication.